As night falls on the mountains, the sounds of birds and the buzzing of insects slip away to near silence, as the first frogs are heard, and their huge, broad bass begins to spread across the valley floor. Then, from nowhere in particular, growing like a great, slow swell in the ocean, the crickets add their pulsating treble. The all-encompassing twilight vibrates with sound. I can no longer hear myself. I shut my eyes in the hammock and await the appearance of stars. Hi, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is the New Books Network seminar. And what I've just read to you is the possibly dolorous tropical lyrical coda at the end of Simon Critchley's new book, ABC of Impossibility. This came out in 2015 with Univocal, and it's a beautiful, texturally satisfying, perfectly sized white book that you'll want to buy and have and hold and carry in your hands and put in your pocket and take with you so that you can read and reread and dip in and come back out again throughout the day and throughout many days. So what this book is a collection of what Critchley calls fragments. These are fragments that range from one line to several pages, and they cover topics that include world, happiness, death, New York City, indirection, Hegel, relationships, Patti Smith, Langer, Augustine, eccentricity, Marx, impossibility, and others. Now, what the book does and what you'll hear in the course of the conversation to come is touch on, sometimes briefly, sometimes not so briefly, some really fascinating and really beautiful moments that help us think through not just world or happiness or suicide or tourism, but also in a way that's very light-handed, but very, very thoughtful, raise, at least for me as a reader, some really interesting threads and themes that are really just really interesting to think with and to think about. It's a beautiful book. It's a thoughtful book. And it's a book that is, I think, a huge pleasure and really, really rewarding to work through, regardless of what field you work in, of what you think you typically like to read, if you just like to read beautiful, thoughtful prose. So we talked about it, and I will let you get to that interview in a moment. But first, thanks so much for listening, for being here with us, and for your support of the podcast. What you'll hear over the course of the interview is actually three voices. You will hear Simon, you will hear me, and you will hear the ghostly musical moaning of the Vancouver wind coming through my windows as we're talking. It's quite stormy outside. It's just the beginning of March. It's very windy. And I am on the 11th floor of a really tall building on the campus of UBC that does not have great insulation. And so think of it, listeners, as a musical soundtrack. Think of it as beautiful fragments of impossibility hovering outside my windows and singing to us and moaning into the conversation as we talk. And thus, you'll hear a bunch of voices in the conversation to come. So thank you so much. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. And thanks for listening. I'm here today to talk with Simon Critchley about his new book, ABC of Impossibility. Welcome to the New Books Network seminar, Simon, and thanks very much for making time to talk with me today. I'm really looking forward to this.
Thanks very much, Carla. Pleasure to be speaking with you.
So, Simon, let's kind of start from the beginning. And this is the question that's traditional for the channel. What are you typically working on when you're not working on this book? What are you typically writing about when you're not writing books that catalog impossible objects?
There's been no pattern, you know. There's a lot of, I suppose, really quite morbid stuff. The last books were, there was a book on suicide, notes on suicide. There was an attempt at a novella called Memory Theater, which is a very strange book. And then a book on Levinas. So there's a book on the French philosopher Emmanuel Levinas last year. So a lot of things last year. So I tend to, you know, have a bit of an attention deficit problems, so I move around. I mean, there are themes in my work, but it's I always like to take right angles. I always like to, you know, when I've done something, then to go off in a 90-degree turn and then think of something else to do. And that's always been my way since I was starting out, really. So I don't know why that's the case, but that's what I do.
So the book that we're talking about is not only a really very fabulously satisfying physical object. It's this small white book. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
It's really satisfying to spend time with. You can really develop a relationship with this book in a way that I really love. But it's a book that's in a format that's going to be relatively unusual, perhaps for readers who come to it for the first time. This is a book that consists in what you call, early on in the book, fragments of an abandoned work that largely date from 2004 to 2006.
Mm-hmm.
So for readers who haven't yet had the benefit of picking up the book, and I hope they'll go run and do that after listening to this, can you talk a little bit for us about the genesis of the work? I'll just leave it there. The genesis of the work. How did this come about?
It was, it seems complicated to me now in the sense in which, the first thing, just to preface it, the book exists because there were these two guys, Drew Burke and Jason Wagner, who run this tiny press called Univocal and in Minneapolis, and they're doing a great job. It's just two of them making these books on their own, and they've begun to put together a really interesting list of titles, and it's one of the kind of interesting developments in publishing. Most interesting development in publishing is the emergence of new small presses, and they have a freedom that the academic presses don't have and the trade presses certainly don't have. And this book is also, it's kind of one of a pair physically, in the sense in which there's a book called Cosmic Pessimism, mm-hmm. written by Eugene Thacker. And Eugene and I are friends, and we teach together. We taught in the Awesome together a course on mysticism, which was very interesting. And his book is entirely black with black on black, and mine is almost entirely white. So the two books together are even more attractive. It's a lovely little object on letterpress, and it's just a beautifully exquisite thing. And I'm very happy with how it looks and feels. The tactile quality of books is really important to me. So that's all great. And this guy, Drew, approached me some years ago. I mean, quite some years ago. I think when he was starting out, whether I had anything. And I didn't. And then I thought about this book that I'd started and abandoned called The ABC of Impossibility. And the idea was to write a kind of book of fragments. And I've been concerned with fragments for a long, long time. Since the early 90s, I've been concerned with writing about fragments and then writing fragments. And then this book kind of appeared as an idea almost fully formed in about 2003-04, as I was moving from England to New York. And I remember thinking of the title. I was in Italy and one summer, and the title came, and I began to think about how it would be arranged. The form of it, the form of things, is always very important to me. So the form began to fall into place, and then I began to kind of, you know, write and collect and assemble fragments, and it all seemed to be taking shape. And and then I stopped, and I did something else. I did a whole number of other things, and I wrote a more kind of manifesto type book in ethics and politics called Infinitely Demanding, that was a kind of yeah, it was that. And then I wrote a book called The Book of Dead Philosophers, which is also fragments, but it's like a chronological and geographical survey of the entire history of philosophy, just through accounts of how philosophers have died since the pre-Socratics to me, basically, although I haven't died yet. And that was also using the fragmentary form. So there was something about the fragment that I was using in the ABC of Impossibility that I can track that through a whole number of other books that I've done and works that I've done, which have this very kind of staccato fragmentary form. It's almost like pop songs. It's almost like kind of and very short pop songs at that. I listen to a lot of music. Mm-hmm. And so going back to it, when I went back to it, when Drew said, you know, that sounds interesting, could you develop that? I then began to go through this pile of stuff that I had and eliminate things quite quickly and then began to get it down to a series of fragments. I then began to arrange in kind of hard copy. I often work with hard copies, and I had them all laid out on the floor, and I was trying to rewrite things and then to find the right sequence, and I hope I eventually got it. So one of the odd things about the book is at the back of the book there's an alphabetical contents list to all the fragments that arguably exist, and then you see which ones are actually in the book. So this is kind of this could be a much bigger book. This is like a small sort of teasing version of a larger enterprise that might or might not see the light of day. We'll see. So it went to other things happened. It was sort of sitting there in a file, and then like a physical file. And when I began to write for the New York Times in about 2009. Mm-hmm. And that was good fun. It is good fun. I still work for them, and I began to write op-eds or short pieces, not so much political op-eds, but short pieces. And again, that became a kind of fragmentary form, you know, learning to write the 800 word piece or make a not necessarily intervention politically, but a kind of a meditation of a certain kind. And some of the things in the ABC of Impossibility found their way into the Times at in about 2009. So there were things I kept going back to and drawing on, and then when I had the chance to turn it into this little form of the book, then I did that last year, I think. Mm-hmm. Don't really remember. something like that. At some point in the past, it was done.
Got it. Now, the form of the book is actually really interesting. And this is, as you've mentioned, there is an alphabetical kind of index right at the back. I mean, there is an alphabetical list of subjects. Not all of them are keyed to particular pages, which is really interesting and I think really fun. Yeah. And seems really important, right? But the ordering of the themes, the ordering of the what we might call chapters, sections, mm-hmm. Is something that you call more thematic, right? And you've just talked about the importance of sequencing, right? Mm-hmm. So as we kind of work through, I think we'll talk a little bit about that. And it's not completely obvious to at least me as a reader why, you know, happiness comes after world or money one comes after relationships or Patti Smith comes after emptiness, etc. But there are some really interesting core themes that emerge from reading from the beginning of it to the end of it that I would like to actually ask you to talk about a little bit. Okay, so it begins after an introduction with fragments. We've already talked about that a little bit, right? You say here are among the fragments of the text that I will throw out into the ether so that listeners can also get fragments of these fragments. Truth is only communicable indirectly in fragments. And we're going to return to this idea of indirection.
Yes. Right? Very important to me.
Yeah, yeah, actually, let's talk about that then. Indirection. Okay. Can you talk about that a little bit then?
Another thing about this book is that it was I mean, you know, obviously all books, all writing belongs to moments in one's life. And this is a moment when I was, I've been introduced by a Brazilian friend to the work of Fernando Pessoa.
Yes.
Who, you know, he was arguably one of the greatest of the modernists, maybe the greatest of all the modernists, but the least known, that's for sure. And I began to read Pessoa, in particular a book of his called The Book of Disquiet, which is kind of a discontinuous piece. And then I read a lot of his poetry. And what Pessoa does with particular force is that he uses what he calls heteronyms. And these heteronyms are names of others. And so Pessoa proceeds as a writer by working in a number of different personages, and it just so happens that the word Pessoa in Portuguese means person. So his own name means person. And indeed his own name, Pessoa, becomes a character in his own work. So one of the names that Pessoa uses is Pessoa. So it gets, there's this kind of galaxy, he calls it a galaxy of names that he produces, each with different styles, different biographies, and different languages. You know, Pessoa wrote in English and in French as well as in Portuguese. And it's, so that was, I was kind of under the spell of that, of those techniques of Pessoa's indirection. But my interest in indirection really goes much further back. And it's, and arguably it's just, kind of structural in the sense in which whatever it is that's going on in our heads at any time is, you know, not that interesting. It can be sometimes interesting, but it's not that interesting, which is what makes blogs so often so boring. But what we do when we read is we enter into another's voice. We live through another's voice. And I think when we read a lot and then when we write, we also enter into all those voices that we've adopted, that we've learned from over the years. So to write in this intense and personal way is only possible through occupying other people's voices, through occupying other personages, as it were. And that's a characteristic of a lot of the writing that interests me most. And that's kind of, is it a paradox? It's an odd thing that, I mean, you can say what's in your mind or in your heart, and that's perfectly fine. But there's something to the way in which whatever is in your mind or in your heart is elevated through the voice of another that one can read and learn from. And then your own voice becomes entangled with the other voice and becomes something else. And then you begin to this odd thing of finding your own voice through reading the voices of others. And that's kind of why we read the history of, why we read books, I guess, because we learn from those other voices something about who we are. And it's an odd experience, if you think about it.
I was in a seminar way back in grad school, way back in grad school. With Arnold Davidson, the Foucault seminar.
Oh, right, okay.
Several years ago, and I had found a translation of the Book of Disquiet somewhere in some random bookstore and just thought, this looks awesome, I'm going to read it. And I had it in class, and he looked at me and he said, you should read that in Portuguese. Just walked off. Okay.
Right.
But it was, this is to say, I was really struck by seeing that in here. And it's a really, really powerful book. And it's one that if listeners haven't had a chance to read that, speaking of reading with other voices, Pessoa's Book of Disquiet, whether or not you read Portuguese, in fact, it's really good.
Yeah, and I tried to, one of the things I was doing when I was, when I was writing the ABC of the Impossible, the first time I was writing it was I was trying to learn Portuguese, and the translations of Pessoa are kind of adaptations of existing translations that my Brazilian friends corrected, and then I did in English. And so I stopped learning Portuguese after a certain point, but it did seem quite important at the time. Although I think translation is really important. I'm all about translation. So, yeah.
And speaking of names and voices, right, another voice and name that comes in here is in a fragment called Critchley.
Yeah.
Since we're talking about heteronyms, right, and names.
Yeah.
In this fragment, you talk about speaking about a book in Barbados at the University of the West Indies and meeting another Critchley. And you tell us in this fragment, Critchley was obviously this man's slave name. And then there's another fragment from the fragment that I'll offer to listeners. It's therefore highly likely that one of my ancestors or near ancestors was a plantation owner or some minion in Barbados. The room begins to fill with blood. Now, I wanted to mention this as well and take us here, not just because of the voices and heteronyms, but because at least in my reading of this, slavery and settlement actually emerge as quite persistent themes throughout the book. So can you talk about that a little bit? What do you, when you reflect on the importance of those themes here, what would you share about that?
It's a really good question, and it is important to me in a way that I'm not sure I really fully understand. You know, it's just the, there are elements like my family's from Liverpool, which is a port, not unlike New York in many ways. As John Lennon used to say, New York reminds them of Liverpool. And so it's a port. It was a place that made its money through the slave trade in the 18th century and then through, the textile industry and what we'd now call capitalism, I guess. And it was also a place where the first, the oldest black community in England is in Liverpool, and the oldest Chinese community in England is in Liverpool. So it's a mixed up place and full of all the kind of tensions. And for me, if I'm thinking about place, and I'm thinking about geography, which I do a lot, then the kind of exemplary figure for that is the port, and rather than the capital city. So I tend to construct, you can have ports that are capital cities, but like London, but it's the idea of the port as this place of passage. That a port is it's an actual physical city that's somehow open to the sea. And I'm always interested in those places that are ports which are kind of porous, which are open to other areas. And then you end up with a very different conception of place, that, you know, the place that is where I'm from, England, is a place that is defined through these porous and, often rather nasty relationships to other places, like Barbados, for example, which is to do with what the English learned from the Portuguese, from about slavery and how to develop sugar as a cash crop, and then all of that. And so I always think that the colonialism, if you like, is. It's something we cannot ignore, particularly in the United States, which was also a colony in very similar ways to somewhere like Barbados. And when you think about place in terms of moving to colonization, then you think of these places as kind of open, as linked to other places. And the way they were linked to other places was through water, was through the sea. And so the sea for me is a very important theme. I was looking at the book before we started to talk, and I was just picking up at how many times I talk about the sea. And the sea is both, you know, a kind of experience of immense tranquility, of calmness, of terror, of the depths of death, for sure, and also of passage. You know, the idea of the sea as a place of passage and movement, and a movement of trade and cargo and people, and that's where I tend to begin thinking about things like society and politics, not through kind of static forms like nations with names like United States or Britain or France with capital cities, but in terms of these histories of movement, these histories of trade, and where if we begin with that, that kind of map, that way of thinking about space, then we end up in a very different place. It means that, you know, somewhere like, you know, what happened to me in that, so what happened to me in the in Barbados, it was the first time I'd been to the Caribbean, and that for me was very, very exciting, because the Caribbean was somewhere where, you know, the Queen's sister used to go to, and, you know, people that wrote James Bond novels and things. So I was there, very exciting. And then it was the, it's 98% black, Barbados, and with a small white elite. And the university was like that too. And there's this moment where I was giving, I wasn't on very good form. I didn't give a very good talk. You know, it wasn't really happening. And this man, Dean Critchley, who was an important figure in the university, asked me a question. And that, so that was kind of a way of registering that and thinking, yes, well, I'm part of that, that kind of nasty, bloody story of colonization. And it was, you know, I don't know what it was, but it was a kind of disturbing moment, an important moment.
You also just evoked the sea, right? That was, you actually evoked several things that I was going to ask you to talk about,
right.
Which is great. And in fact, the sea comes up also in several of these fragments here. In a fragment that talks about suicide, right? And you mentioned this connection between the sea and death. You talk about the impulse here to jump off a terrace, being like being pulled under by the sea.
Yes.
You also talk about in emptiness.
Yeah.
The sort of being obsessed with cities prior to their settlement or at the moment of settlement, but also talk about the sea and have this wonderful suggestion that I hope you'll actually take up one day of writing a volume on the role of silt in shaping world history, which as a historian, I have to just personally ask you to do that because that's fabulous.
Okay. I'd love to write something on silt. I mean, yeah, the history of Western Europe is a history of silt. You
it's
know,
just a fabulous idea.
The history of particularly places like Britain and the Netherlands, and I mean that whole coast is just about silt and about dredging and about, you know, whether you can get the silt. You can turn the silt into arable land. You can drain it, and that you need to get Flemish, you know, specialists over to do that, the engineers or whatever. And I've always been, you know, I would say I like the Netherlands. I spent a lot of time in the Netherlands, in Holland, for over the years. And what's so impressive about that is that, as I say, you know, God created the world, but the Dutch created the Netherlands. They just pulled it out of the sea, out of the silt, and there it is. So there's something emblematic about that. But also, I mean, I tend to look at places, I don't know why, but I mean, I just do like the place I'm in, you know, New York, in terms of its prehistory. You see, you look at a city and you're trying to imagine what it was like before anybody came here, or what the point of first contact was, the first encounter, say, between colonial settlers and the indigenous population, and try to imagine a way, you know, I guess civilization, as far as this is civilization. And then the other thing is, you know, in places that fall into decay, you know, that I've always been interested in ancient history, and the extraordinary thing about ancient history is that there are places of huge, huge importance that just disappear. Or disappear under sand, or disappear under lava, or under whatever it might be, and all the action of the sea, and and that kind of sense in which the fragility of human endeavor, I think, is, and its relationship to the elements is important, and of course it's obviously, you know, becoming very present to us through the experience of climate change.
Right.
Because same thing's going to happen, right? Or it threatens unless we avert the onslaught. which seems we'll see how we do.
Now, another one of the places that comes up frequently here, we've been talking actually quite a bit about the importance of place and movement. And you bring up America or the U.S., right, sort of in different forms throughout the book. Right at the beginning, you remind us that Whitman compared the U.S. to a poem of fragments, right?
That's right.
We'll return to poetry at some point, hopefully before we're done. But you also talk about America in the context of this issue of settlement that we've just been talking about. In the fragment on America, you mentioned that America originates in an act of violent settlement.
Mm-hmm.
But also, you bring up another figure here, which is really interesting, and which perhaps we can talk about a little bit, which is the figure of the virus. You talk about the viral spread of private property, and this idea of a virus and of sort of infection is also something that comes up in the fragment on languor. When you talk about Venus's virus, right, kind of spreading
through.
Great,
I didn't know about that.
Yeah, so it's actually pretty cool, and I was wondering if there's something to that. I mean, is there are you particularly interested in this figure, this kind of viral figure, or is this a way of getting at the broader importance of kind of movement and time and temporality here?
I don't know. I hadn't thought about that. That's really, really interesting. It's I think about the virus in relationship to the settlement of what then became the United States, in terms of, you know, you have this very different understanding of space and settlement and location, which is characteristic of the various numerous indigenous populations of North America, which are then displaced by this new kind of settlement, takes different forms, but the English form tends to be particularly wedded to the idea of private property. And you see that, you know, end up as this kind of virus of a grid system that defines Manhattan, and, you know, the grid of agricultural land and fields that, you know, which when you're flying over the flyover states, you know, you see that the way that the land was organized in that way. And it always feels to me that there's a kind of surface there, right? That there's a, you know, how deep does that go? There's a, you know, you dig down here or where you are, and you're into some totally different way of organizing space. Whereas, you know, where I'm from, you dig down, you find people that are unfamiliar, but it's a different lineage. And the virus in relationship to Phaedra is something else. But I hadn't thought about that connection, but it's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But the virus in that case is much more, I read Racine's play Phaedra when I was in my first weeks at university, and it just made a huge impression on me for reasons I didn't really understand until much later. I'm not sure I really understand them now, but she's just a figure that is, the way she understands it, she wants to, she has this very complicated lineage of what her mother got up to with the Minotaur and all the rest. We don't need to go into details, but the virus of Eros is in her blood, and she knows that she's infected by it, and it tortures her, and there's no escape from that virus for her. And that's Phaedra's story, but I think it suggests a lot of things to me.
Venus does that to people, right? I mean, if you think about what happens to Dido, and you think about what's happening in the Aeneid, I mean, Venus is constantly like, Cupid, go infect so-and-so with, you know, passion or love or whatever. There is actually a really interesting, as you bring up the figure of the virus here, it really does make me think differently about the kind of mode of practice and action that Venus has in a lot of these literary references. So,
Venus infects us through the senses, through the eyes, through the ears, through all the senses, and what it awakens in us. This is how it would work with Phaedra, but I think this is more general. Is what it awakens in us is a kind of virus that has an ancestry. You know, it's you know the tricky thing, to say the least, about the tricky thing is, you know, how we put together love and desire. That's really, really tricky. But the way in which what we desire and who we love and who we desire and who we love, the way in which the figures that we love and desire are ones which will have an ancestry, will take us back to maybe what our parents loved and desired, or our love and desire for our parents, you know, all of that stuff, all that messy stuff, which I'm a, you know, a student of Greek tragedy, you know, to a rather large degree, and that all those characters in Greek tragedy are characters who are contaminated by a virus that came to them, as it were, from the womb and attacked them to the past in a way that they can't ever fully escape. So whatever their agency is, whatever their freedom means, it's always in proportion to their determination by that past. And I think that tends to be the way I see human behavior, very, very, very crudely. And therefore the most dangerous thing to do is to disavow the past. There's this one of my favorite films, one of many people's favorite films, is Magnolia by Paul Thomas Anderson. And he's a genius, but in that film, I think on at least four occasions, there's this line that comes up, as the man says, or as the book says, you might be through with the past, but the past isn't through with you. And that's the way I tend to think about it. If we think we're through with the past, we can make an absolute new start or whatever it might be, then that's when the past will snatch us back, will infect us in some even worse way. So the only, as it were, antidote to that, or the only way of thinking that through is by accepting the extent to which we are constituted and infected by forces that are not really in our control.
And this actually plays out really nicely, and this transitions really nicely from one to another theme in the case of Phaedra, which is the importance of time. You describe Phaedra in relation to time in this way. She's always too late to meet her fate, and this is why she's so utterly fatigued. And in fact, time and the importance of sort of experiences of time really comes up all over the book. You talk sorry?
That's interesting. I hadn't really thought about that. That's great.
I mean, even going back to the sort of beginning-ish in the fragment of on happiness, you talk about the experience of, in the words of the book, momentary self-sufficiency that's bound up with the experience of time. And, and really it comes up all over. I mean, did you want to reflect on that a little bit? Sort of thinking about the
importance Well, firstly, I mean, what's nice about this conversation is that, I mean, I've written a lot of stuff, and I've done a lot of interviews, and it all becomes very formulaic after a while. Like, I've done, I don't know how many things about David Bowie in the last 6 weeks, and I'm really happy to do that, because I love David Bowie, and he's very important to me, and he's very important, but this book, with this little tiny press in Minneapolis, I haven't really talked about it much. I did an attempt at a kind of a reading with Eugene Thacker in Williamsburg in November, and so it's kind of just popped out there, and I've not really thought about it very much. It's very interesting what you're saying, and I'm pleased that you're seeing these themes, which they're there. I'm not really as conscious of them as I should be. But time, I mean, kind of the way it, I guess the kind of way it works with me is that I begin from an idea that we don't coincide with ourselves. So the idea of self-coincidence, I am I, or I think therefore I am, or whatever it might be, the idea of self-coincidence, which we which we think of as kind of obvious, is just ain't the case. That we are the sort of creatures who are, as I say somewhere in the book, eccentric with regard to ourselves, that we're kind of out of sync with ourselves, and we constantly fail to coincide with ourselves. And that's kind of rich and interesting, I think. It's a fascinating thing to explore. So that's that sense in which, you know, we're always kind of, we're out of time, you know, and time is always out of joint, you know. And again, I think about that obviously in relationship to drama, and obviously Shakespeare, Hamlet. I mean, if Hamlet is the, you know, the quintessential, you know, existential ruminating person, then, you know, whatever we can say about Hamlet, he doesn't coincide with himself, right? He kind of is constituted by a set of relationships, most obviously with the ghost of his dead father, who has the same name as him, mm-hmm. and who pops up and tells him to avenge his murder. And so, and I think that the, so I think identity in that sense, self-identity is that, is the feature which most defines it, is that lack of self-coincidence, which I don't see as a deficit. I see it as a kind of productive thing. It makes us the kind of interesting creatures that we are. Now, that said, I mean, there's a fragment called Happiness, which is not a big theme in my work, but which is a reflection on Rousseau. And if ever there were anybody that didn't coincide with himself, it was Rousseau. Rousseau even wrote, you know, books about the fact that he didn't coincide with himself. You know, Rousseau, Critique of Jean-Jacques, or Jean-Jacques, you know, Critique of Rousseau, whichever way around it is, the second autobiography. He writes three. In the third autobiography, Confessions being the first, Reveries of a Solitary Walker, there's this moment when Rousseau reflects on his experience in a boat on the Lake of Vienne in Switzerland, and of him having gone off botanizing for a while. He took great delight in botany, and then rowing back to the shore and just letting the boat drift, and then lying down in the boat. At that point, there was he had a feeling of existence, which was a feeling of, I guess, a kind of sentient awareness of being sufficient for a moment, and mm-hmm. and kind of godlike at that point.
Right.
And it doesn't last very long, but the fact that someone as hyper self-conscious as Rousseau would feel it, I find really interesting. So that was one of those moments. I mean, the book, in many ways, in retrospect, it's, you know, and this is kind of how I function. I don't know why I function this way, but how I function. I'll just find quotes and I will, you know, squirrel them away somewhere. And that quote from Rousseau, from whatever chapter it is of the Reveries, was just, I wanted to get that into some form or other at some point. And yeah, and it's a strange moment. So that's if you like the moment when even a creature like Rousseau could coincide with himself and feel a kind of sufficiency. But most of the time we experience ourselves as being kind of out of joint.
And to experience that self-sufficiency is described here as to be without time, right? Which is just,
yeah.
Again, like, just really, really interesting.
Yeah, it's like that line from Wittgenstein where it says the eternal life is given to those who live in the present. Mm-hmm. So if eternity exists, it exists as some kind of experience of the present, some kind of extension of that, which is one way of, you know, was one way of thinking about God as existing in a kind of eternal presence, which sounds really nice. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't, I'm not sure. But we, for the most part, don't experience that. We kind of, we experience these three dimensions of time simultaneously as dimensions which pull us one way and the other continually. And for most of the time, we can manage that. We can manage that in relation to the past, the present, and the future. But often that becomes too much, and we kind of fall apart. And that's when the past can rear up behind us and bite us, and when the future doesn't appear, but when there doesn't appear to be a future, you know, that can sometimes happen. I was thinking about this in relationship to, I was reading, my mother died before Christmas, which is a whole other story. But I was reading a lot of things about grief, most of which were by women. It was interesting. I wasn't kind of choosing things by women, but in my little survey, it was anyway. And I was reading a text by an English poet called Denise Riley, and she talks about she's meditating on the death of her son, and it's an incredibly moving piece of writing because it's not sentimental at all. I mean, she's someone that was sort of trained philosophically. She's really trying to work out what was going on with her. The one thing she says is that to be able to write, one must take an interest in the future. Even if that future is one's posthumous future, right? One must take an interest in the future. And the experience of, say, bereavement, grave bereavement, as it were, is an experience where that future disappears. A future simply ceases to happen. Pretty strange. So that's a whole other experience of time. And she talks about this in relationship to her experience of grief, but grief is the wrong word. She says that over and over again. But her experience of trying to deal with the death of her son, and what it induces in her is a kind of experience of time coming to a stop. Time just won't budge. Time loses its flow, loses its character of movement, and it also makes writing impossible because, you know, there's no future to write for. So, yeah, so I think the it's a fascinating set of topics, actually.
Yeah, and it's actually just to kind of mention for listeners again, who hopefully will pick up the book if they haven't already, these themes are also really interestingly interwoven in the section on death in the book. You talk, and you can hear the background singing, what I like to think of as the music of the wind whistling through the windows of my office, probably. Just think of it as a chorus, if you can hear that. So we'll have music in the background, and music is one of the themes that we could talk about if we had more time. But in the section of death, the book says, it's in mourning and grief that we most become ourselves. And if it's true that that the experience of time or being out of time or stopping time is also, right, the experience of somehow being most oneself, you can kind of see how these come together. And there's a coda as well that you leave us with that also in a way embodies the experience of being kind of out of time in really a sort of delicious way, I think, at the end. That also brings together a lot of the kinds of things that that we've been talking about.
That was actually based on an experience, which was, I was in the Brazilian, in the countryside behind Rio de Janeiro in Brazil, in what to me felt like the jungle. But it was just the countryside. I'd never really experienced the jungle before. And there was that, it was just an extraordinary experience of a day ending, and a whole series of noises, the noises of insects in particular, and birds subsiding, and then being replaced by the sound of frogs. And just this, the whole area was just reverberating with this noise of frogs. It was an extraordinary experience. So I lay out there for quite a long time and then came back in. And the next morning I woke up and I looked like, you know, pizza margarita. I was just I've been bitten to death. I'd never been bitten as badly in my life. It was really, really terrible. But it was worth it for the experience. And that's also a kind of, that the code of the book is also a kind of a nod to Fernando Pessoa as well, an evocation of that, of that personage.
So maybe as we're sort of coming toward what will be a conclusion of our conversation, there's one theme that we haven't yet talked about, but I'd like to mention, because it's also a really persistent theme throughout the book. And in the fragment on impossibility, you mention this as one of the three themes that are perhaps three impossible objects that you talk about, in addition to poetry, which we could talk about for another hour at least. There's this beautiful material on surfaces and poetry in here that I just love, in addition to music, which we could
I'm pleased with the poetry. I mean, I'm happy with that. That's one of the few bits I'm really happy with that.
Let's go there. Let's maybe close with that. I wanted to bring us eventually to the comic, right, to humor and satire. Yeah. But to get there, let's go to poetry first, because the surfaciality fragment was actually one of my favorites in the book, and I really loved that. And if you were particularly pleased with the way poetry worked out, I would actually like to hear a little bit about that. Why were you particularly pleased about that? What were you hoping the poetry material was going to do in the book? And
I'm meant to be a philosopher, and some people would dispute that. At least I can claim to teach philosophy, and although some people would probably even dispute that, but you're meant to be deep as a philosopher. You're meant to be concerned with what's below the surfaces of the appearances and to the heart of the matter and truth. And we construct axioms, which pick out the structure of reality and so on and so forth. And we see the meaning of something which is not apparent to the senses. It's hidden. Descartes, whatever. And I just think that's, whether that's true or not, that's not what I do. What interests me in relation to poetry is the way in which poetry can get us to attend to the surfaces of things, and the surfaces of things in their rich kind of context of meaning. Like they're a rich web of meaning, which is kind of what's under our eyes or in front of our eyes the whole time, but we usually don't see because we're too preoccupied with habit, routine, with what we expect to see. And so what the poet can do for me, and I've got like a little sort of mini canon of poets that I cling to, the most important of which, I guess, is Wallace Stevens, particularly the late Wallace Stevens. And what fascinates me about the late work of Wallace Stevens is that he's trying to attend to what he sees, and to describe what's happening outside a window, looking through a window at a bird on a branch, as simple as that. Or to, like Elizabeth Bishop, when she's trying to describe putting her hand in salt water, and so poetry for me is about the return to the surfaces of things that we inhabit, that we live in, but we don't see because it's kind of too blindingly obvious to us. It's too familiar. And I guess a line of thought that I've been attracted to, which you can link to figures like the figures like Wittgenstein, is that we don't see the everyday. The everyday is really what matters, and we don't see it because we're always looking through it to find God or the brain or our DNA or whatever. And what we should be attending to is what shows up, what appears. And the easiest way for us to see that is through the indirection of someone else's voice. So a poet can point those things out to us, or a movie maker can point those things out to us in a particularly powerful way. And that's also connected to the theme of impossibility, in a way that You know, there's a kind of playful side to this in the sense in which the theory of impossible objects is the idea that whatever I say about the things which interest me, let's say poetry, music, and humor, is not required by those things. It's kind of redundant. I like the idea of my own redundancy as a figure in relationship to those things which I love. So, I mean, I've always seen my role, for reasons again that I don't really understand, is I can try to point people towards something else. I can hopefully point people towards, say, the verse of Wallace Stevens, and they can perhaps find something in that that would be of interest. And at that point, my role kind of evaporates. So I kind of like the idea of the philosopher as a kind of, what's that website? Is it Snapchat? Or is Snapchat, which evaporates, right?
Oh, I think so. Yeah,
I think it's like a philosophical Snapchat. You just kind of you make a certain remark, and then it would just kind of like a bubble, would just like poof, but you'd be pointed towards that which you want to point someone towards, and that's what's important. And the thing is that we live within an average everyday world, whatever constitutes that, whether that's the wind coming through your window or the sound of my fridge here. And it takes us a long time to, we find that difficult to attend to. And it's, one of the great virtues of poetry is that it enables us to attend to that by being about something else. And then we can return to what is in front of us with a slightly different eye. And that's what I'd like to do.
I love that. And in fact, for the last thing I'll ask you, rather than asking you about humor, even though I said I was going to do that, listeners, there is lots of stuff about humor,
lots
satire. I would like to just ask you.
Big laugh.
Big laughs. It's hilarious.
Hilarious.
but before, rather than that, what I'd like to do is just to ask you one more thing about poetry, and then we'll kind of wrap up. And specifically,
okay.
Poems aren't pies, we aren't herring.
Yeah.
It's just, it's there on the page, right? It's like Vardaman, my mother is a fish. I mean, it's just there. And then it's really powerful. Did you want to speak to that? Poems aren't pies, we aren't herring. Or do you want to just leave it there?
We could leave it there. It's one of those things I found. I was, I don't know where I found that. I mean, it was, I was told it. I think I went to, it might have been an artist or some kind of presentation at a seminar, a long, long time ago. There's one of those quotes that I was just carrying around in my kind of file of quotes that I carry around, and I finally found a place for it. Poems aren't pies, we aren't herring. I mean, and at one level, yes, it seems obvious. Poems aren't pies, we aren't herring, but maybe not. I mean, how do we, I'm very fond of herring. And I eat an awful lot of herring. So if I, just ate herring for the next couple of years, I'd be, more than part herring. And and similarly, we could imagine, why aren't poems pies? I mean, we could imagine the kind of the poetry of the pie maker. So it's one of those kind of, it's an absurdist moment. There's a couple of absurdist moments in the book. Mm-hmm. The other one which comes to mind is the, when Heidegger says tourism should be banned.
Oh, yeah.
And
about Germany.
Particularly when I visit Germany. And so one of those hilarious moments in this hilarious book. And, so I find that humor is important for all sorts of reasons because there's, for me, to make it like a sort of 30-second version of it, humor, I mean, good humor, and there's an awful lot of bad humor, we know that, but really good humor does what philosophy is meant to do, I think, but it does it in a way that, in a sense, we already understand. To be able to describe the number of, as it were, thought experiments, conceptual games that go on in a series of well-told jokes, and sort of re-describe that in philosophical terms would be very, very complicated. We possess that insofar as we are capable of, you know, hearing jokes, telling jokes, exchanging humor, or humor being the kind of the bond of sociability that we have. We're capable of this enormous intelligence and sophistication in a really everyday life practice. That's what interests me. So, when people say philosophy is difficult, philosophy, that must be difficult. And I think that's not true. Everything that you need to do in philosophy is really, it can be encapsulated in really what it means to understand and tell a joke.
Mm-hmm. Fabulous. I think that's a good place to wrap it up, actually. Excellent. I think that's a really nice note to end on. So, Simon, there's a ton of stuff, right, as we've talked about already, that we haven't talked about, that we could talk about for hours more. But given that we're at our conclusion, is there anything else in particular that we didn't have a chance to talk about but that you'd like to mention for listeners?
No, nothing really. And I'm very happy if they got this far in the listening to us speak. I'd be flattered and delighted.
And assuming that they do, what are you working on now that the book is out? What's currently inspiring you?
Well, and I've taken a minute, you know, I'm sort of going through probably another right turn. So I did a whole number of things came out last year, one of which was the ABC of Impossibility, and I felt a kind of nausea with how much stuff was coming out. And so I then vowed to stop writing for the foreseeable future. But of course, you know,
good luck with that, right?
Too vain and narcissistic to, you know, of course I'll carry on. But I'm thinking now about writing something on Julian of Norwich, medieval Christian mystic, for reasons that are not completely apparent to me, but one of the most obvious kind of facts about Julian of Norwich was it was the first her book Showings, first published in, the first written in 1382, was the first book in English by an English woman. And it just strikes me, one thing is it just strikes me that's important in and of itself. And what she does in this book is to construct a kind of informal theology of love, which I find really fascinating. And so I've been, so I'm thinking about writing something on her and connecting it with the great Canadian poet Anne Carson.
Oh, I love her.
So I'm thinking of connecting it to Anne Carson's text. There's a book that she did about 10 years ago now called Decreation. I've read stuff, but Decreation, there's this essay in there on Sappho, Marguerite Porat, and Simone Weil. And I found something in there last year. I found a kind of sometimes when you write, when you're reading and making notes, you think you found a lever or found some kind of key. I think I found something there that at least for a few pages could be interesting, and that could be thinking about the problem of writing and Anne Carson. So when Anne Carson says, there's too much self in my writing, she says that there's too much self in my writing. And I want to look at that question of the self in relationship to writing and what it is that we're doing when we write. Because what we're doing when we're writing at one level is just we're saying self, self, self. But most people that write are trying to do something else. So what is it they're trying to do? Mm-hmm. And these mystics like Julian of Norwich were in the business of doing that too. And they called that other thing that wasn't their self God. I'm not so sure about that, but I accept the sincerity of the enterprise. So I'm going to try and fiddle with that for a while.
Well, I was about to say, why are you not writing the world history of Silt? But if it involves Anne Carson, then that's okay.
That's forgivable.
It's okay. Well, Simon, thank you so much. It's really been a pleasure. And thanks so much for making the time.
Thank you very much for having me.
You've been listening to the New Books Network Seminar. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.